This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The History of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. Translated by Richard Crawley. Book 1, Chapter 5.
Second Congress at Lacedaemon. Preparations for War and Diplomatic Skirmishes. Ceylon, Pausanias, Themistocles. After this, though not many years later, we at length come to what has already related, the affairs of Corcyra and Potidaea, and the events that served as a pretext for the present war. All these actions of the Hellenes against each other and the barbarian occurred in the 50 years interval between the retreat of Xerxes and the beginning of the present war. During this interval, the Athenians succeeded in placing their empire on a firmer basis, and advanced their own home power to a very great height. The Lacedaemonians, though fully aware of it, opposed it only for a little while, but remained inactive during most of the period, being of old slow to go to war except under the pressure of necessity, and in the present instance being hampered by wars at home. Until the growth of the Athenian power could be no longer ignored, and their confederacy became the object of its encroachments. They then felt they could endure it no longer, but that the time had come for them to throw themselves heart and soul upon the hostile power, and break it, if they could, by commencing the present war. And though the Lacedaemonians had made up their own minds on the fact of the breach of the treaty and the guilt of the Athenians, yet they sent to Delphi and inquired of the god whether it would be well with them if they went to war, and, as it is reported, received from him the answer that if they put their whole strength into the war, victory would be theirs, and the promise that he himself would be with them, whether invoked or uninvoked. Still, they wished to summon their allies again, and to take their vote on the propriety of making war. After the ambassadors from the confederates had arrived, and a congress had been convened, they all spoke their minds, most of them denouncing the Athenians and demanding that the war should begin, in particular the Corinthians. They had before, on their own account, canvassed the cities in detail to induce them to vote for the war, in the fear that it might come too late to save Potidaea. They were present also on this occasion, and came forward the last, and made the following speech. Fellow allies, we can no longer accuse the Lacedaemonians of having failed in their duty. They have not only voted for war themselves, but have assembled us here for that purpose. We say their duty, for supremacy has its duties. Besides equitably administering private interests, leaders are required to show a special care for the common welfare in return for the special honors accorded to them by all in other ways. For ourselves, all who have already had dealings with the Athenians require no warning to be on their guard against them. The states more inland and out of the highway of communication should understand that, if they omit to support the coast powers, the result will be to injure the transit of their produce for exportation and the reception and exchange of their imports from the sea. And they must not be careless judges of what is now said, as if it had nothing to do with them, but must expect that the sacrifice of the powers on the coast will one day be followed by the extension of the danger to the interior, and must recognize that their own interests are deeply involved in this discussion. For these reasons they should not hesitate to exchange peace for war. If wise men remain quiet while they are not injured, brave men abandon peace for war when they are injured, returning to an understanding on a favorable opportunity. In fact, they are neither intoxicated by their success in war, nor disposed to take an injury for the sake of the delightful tranquility of peace. Indeed, to falter for the sake of such delights is, if you remain inactive, the quickest way of losing the sweets of repose to which you cling, while to conceive extravagant, pretentious success in war is to forget how hollow is the confidence by which you are elated. For if many ill-conceived plans have succeeded through the still greater fatuity of an opponent, many more, apparently well laid, have on the contrary ended in disgrace. The confidence with which we form our schemes is never completely justified in their execution. Speculation is carried on in safety, but, when it comes to action, fear causes failure. To apply these rules to ourselves, if we are now kindling war, it is under the pressure of injury, with adequate grounds of complaint. And after we have chastised the Athenians, we will in season desist. We have many reasons to expect success. First, superiority in numbers and in military experience. And second, our general and unvarying obedience in the execution of orders. The naval strength which they possess shall be raised by us from our respective antecedent resources, and from the monies at Olympia and Delphi. Alone from these enables us to seduce their foreign sailors by the offer of higher pay, for the power of Athens is more mercenary than national. While ours will not be exposed to the same risk, as its strength lies more in men than in money. A single defeat at sea is in all likelihood their ruin. Should they hold out, in that case there will be the more time for us to exercise ourselves in naval matters, and as soon as we have arrived at an equality in science, we need scarcely ask whether we shall be their superiors in courage. For the advantages that we have by nature they cannot acquire by education, while their superiority in science must be removed by our practice. The money required for these objects shall be provided by our contributions. Nothing, indeed, could be more monstrous than the suggestion that, while their allies never tire of contributing for their own servitude, we should refuse to spend for vengeance and self-preservation the treasure by which such refusal we shall forfeit to Athenian rapacity and see employed for our own ruin. We have also other ways of carrying on the war, such as revolt of their allies, the surest method of depriving them of their revenues, which are the source of their strength, and establishment of fortified positions in their country, and various operations which cannot be foreseen at present. For war of all things proceeds least upon definite rules, but draws principally upon itself for contrivances to meet an emergency, and in such cases the party who faces the struggle and keeps his temper best meets with most security, and he who loses his temper about it with correspondent disaster. Let us also reflect that if it was merely a number of disputes of territory between rival neighbors, it might be borne. But here we have an enemy in Athens that is a match for our whole coalition, and more than a match for any of its members, so that unless as a body, and as individual nationalities and individual cities, we make a unanimous stand against her, she will easily conquer us, divided and in detail. That conquest, terrible as it may sound, would, it must be known, have no other end than slavery, pure and simple. A world which Peloponnese cannot even hear whispered without disgrace, or without disgrace see so many states abused by one. Meanwhile, the opinion would be either that we were justly so used, or that we put up with it from cowardice, and were proving degenerate sons and not even securing for ourselves the freedom which our fathers gave to Hellas, and in allowing the establishment in Hellas of a tyrant state, though in individual states we think it our duty to put down sole rulers. And we do not know how this conduct can be held free from three of the gravest failings, want of sense, of courage, or of vigilance. For we do not suppose that you have taken refuge in that contempt of an enemy which has proved so fatal in so many instances, a feeling which from the numbers that it has ruined has come to be called not contemptuous, but contemptible. There is, however, no advantage in reflections on the past further than may be of service to the present. For the future we must provide by maintaining what the present gives us and redoubling our efforts. It is hereditary to us to win virtue as the fruit of labor, and you must not change the habit, even though you should have a slight advantage in wealth and resources, for it is not right that what was won in want should be lost in plenty. No, we must boldly advance to the war for many reasons. The God has commanded it and promised to be with us, and the rest of Hellas will all join in the struggle, part from fear, part from interest. You will be the first to break a treaty, which the God, in advising us to go to war, judges to be violated already, but rather to support a treaty that has been outraged. Indeed, treaties are broken not by resistance, but by aggression. Your position, therefore, from whatever quarter you may view it, will amply justify you in going to war. And this step we recommend in the interests of all, bearing in mind that identity of interest is the surest of bonds, whether between states or individuals. Delay not, therefore, to assist Potidæa, a Dorian city besieged by Ionians, which is quite a reversal of the order of things, nor to assert the freedom of the rest. It is impossible for us to wait any longer when waiting can only mean immediate disaster for some of us, and, if it comes to be known that we have conferred but do not venture to protect ourselves, like disaster in the near future for the rest. Delay not, fellow allies, but, convinced of the necessity of the crisis and the wisdom of this council, vote for the war, undeterred by its immediate terrors, but looking beyond to the lasting peace by which it will be succeeded. Out of war, peace gains fresh stability, but to refuse to abandon repose for war is not so sure a method of avoiding danger. We must believe that the tyrant city that has been established in Hellas has been established against all alike, with a program of universal empire, part fulfilled, part in contemplation. Let us not attack and reduce it, and win future security for ourselves and freedom for the Hellenes who are now enslaved. Such were the words of the Corinthians. The Lacedaemonians, having now heard all, give their opinion, took the vote of all the allied states present in order, great and small alike, and the majority voted for war. This decided, it was still impossible for them to commence at once, from their want of preparation, but it was resolved that the means requisite were to be procured by the different states, and that there was to be no delay. And indeed, in spite of the time occupied with the necessary arrangements, less than a year elapsed before Attica was invaded, and the war openly begun. This interval was spent in sending embassies to Athens, charged with complaints, in order to obtain as good a pretext for war as possible, in the event of her paying no attention to them. The first Lacedaemonian assembly was to order the Athenians to drive out the curse of the goddess, the history of which is as follows. In former generations there was an Athenian of the name of Cylon, a victor at the Olympic Games, of good birth and powerful position, who had married a daughter of Theagenes, a Megarian, at that time tyrant of Megara. Now this Cylon was inquiring at Delphi, when he was told by the god to seize the Acropolis of Athens on the grand festival of Zeus. Accordingly, procuring a force from Theagenes, and persuading his friends to join him, when the Olympic festival in Peloponnese came, he seized the Acropolis, with the intention of making himself tyrant, thinking that this was the grand festival of Zeus, and also an occasion appropriate for a victory at the Olympic Games. Whether the grand festival that was meant was in Attica or elsewhere was a question which he never thought of, and which the oracle did not offer to solve. For the Athenians also have a festival which is called the grand festival of Zeus, Mylikios or Gracious, or also the Diasia. It is celebrated outside the city, and the whole people sacrifice not real victims, but a number of bloodless offerings peculiar to the country. However, fancying he had chosen the right time, he made the attempt. As soon as the Athenians perceived it, they flocked in, one and all, from the country, and sat down, and laid siege to the citadel. But as time went on, weary of the labor of the blockade, most of them departed, the responsibility of keeping guard being left to the 9 archons, with plenary powers to arrange everything according to their good judgment. It must be known that at that time most political functions were discharged by the 9 archons. Meanwhile, Cylon and his besieged companions were distressed for want of food and water. Accordingly, Cylon and his brother made their escape, but the rest, being hard-pressed and sometimes even dying of famine, seated themselves as suppliants at the altar in the Acropolis. The Athenians, who were charged with the duty of keeping guard, when they saw them at the point of death in the temple, raised them up on the understanding that no harm should be done to them, led them out, and slew them. Some, who as they passed by took refuge at the altars of the awful goddesses, were dispatched on the spot. From this deed, the men who killed them were called accursed and guilty against the goddess, they and their descendants. Accordingly, these cursed ones were driven out by the Athenians, driven out again by Cleomenes of Lacedaemon and an Athenian faction. The living were driven out, and the bones of the dead were taken up. Thus they were cast out. For all that, they came back afterwards, and their descendants are still in the city. This, then, was the curse that the Lacedaemonians ordered them to drive out. They were actuated primarily, as they pretended, by a care for the honor of the gods, but they also knew that Pericles, son of Xanthippus, was connected with the curse on his mother's side, and they thought that this banishment would materially advance their designs on Athens. Not that they really hoped to succeed in procuring this. They rather thought to create a prejudice against him in the eyes of his countrymen, from the feeling that the war would be partly caused by his misfortune. For being the most powerful man of his time, and the leading Athenian statesman, he opposed the Lacedaemonians in everything, and would have no concessions, but ever urged the Athenians on to war. The Athenians retorted by ordering the Lacedaemonians to drive out the curse of Tenarus. The Lacedaemonians had once raised up some helot suppliants from the temple of Poseidon at Tenarus, led them away and slain them, for which they believed the great earthquake at Sparta to have been a retribution. The Athenians also ordered them to drive out the curse of the goddess of the Brazen House, the history of which is as follows. After Pausanias, the Lacedaemonian had been recalled by the Spartans from his command in the Hellespont. This is his first recall, and had been tried by them and acquitted. Not being again sent out in public capacity, he took a galley of Hermione on his own responsibility, without the authority of the Lacedaemonians, and arrived as a private person in the Hellespont. He came ostensibly for the Hellenic War, really to carry on his intrigues with the king, which he had begun before his recall, being ambitious of reigning over Hellas. The circumstance which first enabled him to lay the king under an obligation, and to make a beginning of the whole design, was this. Some connections and kinsmen of the king had been taken in Byzantium, on its capture from the Medes, when he was first there, after the return from Cyprus. These captives he sent off to the king without the knowledge of the rest of the allies, the account being that they had escaped from him. He managed this with the help of Gongylus, an Eretrian, whom he had placed in charge of Byzantium and the prisoners. He also gave Gongylus a letter for the king, the contents of which were as follows, as was afterwards discovered. Pausanias, the general of Sparta, anxious to do you a favor, send you these, his prisoners of war. I propose also, with your approval, to marry your daughter, and to make Sparta and the rest of Hellas subject to you. I may say I think I am able to do this, with your cooperation. Accordingly, if any of this please you, send a safe man to the sea, through whom we may in future conduct our correspondence. This was all that was revealed in the writing, and Xerxes was pleased with the letter. He sent off Artabazus, son of Pharnaces, to the sea with orders to supersede Megabates, the previous governor in the satrapy of Daskylion, and to send over as quickly as possible to Pausanias at Byzantium a letter which he entrusted to him, to show him the royal signet, and to execute any commission which he might receive from Pausanias on the king's matters with all care and fidelity. Artabazus, on his arrival, carried the king's orders into effect, and sent over the letter, which contained the following answer. Thus saith King Xerxes to Pausanias, for the men whom you have saved for me across the sea from Byzantium, an obligation is laid up for you in our house, recorded forever, and with your proposals I am well pleased. Let neither night or day stop you from diligently performing any of your promises to me. Neither for cost of gold nor of silver let them be hindered, nor yet for number of troops. Wherever it may be that their presence is needed, but with Artabazus, an honorable man whom I send you, boldly advance my objects and yours, as may be most for the honor and interest of us both. Before held in high honor by the Hellenes as the hero of Plataea, Pausanias, after the receipt of this letter, became prouder than ever, and could no longer live in the usual style, but went out of Byzantium in a Median dress, was attended on his march through Thrace by a bodyguard of Medes and Egyptians, kept a Persian table, and was quite unable to contain his intentions, but betrayed by his conduct in trifles what his ambition looked one day to enact on a grander scale. He also made himself difficult of access, and displayed so violent a temper to every one without exception that no one could come near him. Indeed, This was the principal reason why the confederacy went over to the Athenians. The above-mentioned conduct, coming to the ears of the Lacedaemonians, occasioned his first recall, and after his second voyage out in the ship of Hermione, without their orders, he gave proofs of similar behavior. Besieged and expelled from Byzantium by the Athenians, he did not return to Sparta, but news came that he had settled at Colonae in the Troad, and was intriguing with the barbarians, and that his stay there was for no good purpose. And the ephors, no longer hesitating, sent him a herald and a sictail, with orders to accompany the herald or be declared a public enemy. Anxious above everything to avoid suspicion, and confident that he could quash the charge by means of money, he returned a second time to Sparta. At first thrown into prison by the ephors, whose powers enabled them to do this to the king, soon compromised the matter and came out again, and offered himself for trial to any who wished to institute an inquiry concerning him. Now the Spartans had no tangible proof against him, neither his enemies nor the nation, of that indubitable kind required for the punishment of a member of the royal family, and at that moment in high office. He being regent for his first cousin, King Pleistarchus, Leonidas's son, who was still a minor. But by his contempt of the laws and imitation of the barbarians, he gave grounds for much suspicion of his being discounted with things established. All the occasions on which he had in any way departed from the regular customs were passed in review, and it was remembered that he had taken upon himself to have inscribed on the tripod at Delphi, which was dedicated by the Hellenes as the first fruits of the spoil of the Medes, the following couplet. The Mede, defeated, great Pausanias raised this monument, that Phoebus might be praised. At the time the Lacedaemonians had at once erased the couplet, and inscribed the names of the cities that had aided in the overthrow of the barbarian and dedicated the offer. Yet it was considered that Pausanias had here been guilty of a grave offense, which, interpreted by the light of the attitude which he had since assumed, gained a new significance, and seemed to be quite in keeping with his present schemes. Besides, they were informed that he was even intriguing with the Helots. And such indeed was the fact, for he promised them freedom and citizenship if they would join him in the insurrection, and would help him to carry out his plans to the end. Even now, mistrusting the evidence, even of the Helots themselves, the ephors would not consent to take any decided step against him, in accordance with their regular custom towards themselves, namely, to be slow in taking any irrevocable resolve in the matter of a Spartan citizen without indisputable proof. At last, it is said, the person who was going to carry to Artabazus the last letter for the king, a man of Argolis, once the favorite and most trusty servant of Pausanias, turned informer. Alarmed by the reflection that none of the previous messengers had ever returned, having counterfeited the seal, in order that, if he found himself mistaken in his surmises, or if Pausanias should ask to make some correction, he might not be discovered, he undid the letter and found the postscript that he had suspected, i.e. an order to put him to death. On being shown the letter, the ephors now felt more certain. Still, they wished to hear Pausanias commit himself with their own ears. Accordingly, the man went by appointment to Tenarus as a suppliant, and there built himself a hut divided into two by a partition, within which he concealed some of the ephors and let them hear the whole matter plainly. For Pausanias came to him and asked him the reason of his suppliant position, and then the man reproached him with the order that he had written concerning him, and one by one declared all the rest of the circumstances, how he who had never yet brought him into any danger while employed as agent between him and the king, was yet just like the mass of his servants to be rewarded with death. Admitting all this, and telling him not to be angry about the matter, Pausanias gave him the pledge of raising him up from the temple, and begged him to set off as quickly as possible, and not to hinder the business in hand. The ephors listened carefully, and then departed, taking no action for the moment, but having at last attained certainty, were preparing to arrest him in the city. It is reported that, as he was about to be arrested in the street, he saw from the face of one of the ephors what was coming. Another, too, made him a secret signal and betrayed it to him from kindness. Setting off with a run for the temple of the goddess of the Brazen House, the enclosure of which was near at hand, he succeeded in taking sanctuary before they took him, and entering into a small chamber which formed part of the temple to avoid being exposed to the weather, lay still there. The ephors, for the moment distanced in the pursuit, afterwards took off the roof of the chamber, and having made sure that he was inside, shut him in, barricaded the doors, and, staying before the place, reduced him by starvation. When they found that he was on the point of expiring, just as he was, in the chamber, they brought him out of the temple, while the breath was still in him, and as soon as he was brought out, he died. They were going to throw him into the Gyades, where they cast criminals, but finally decided to inter him somewhere near. But the god at Delphi afterwards ordered the Lacedaemonians to remove the tomb to the place of his death, where he now lies in the consecrated ground, as an inscription on a monument declares, and as what had been done was a curse to them, to give back two bodies instead of one to the goddess of the Brazen House. So they had two brazen statues made, and dedicated themselves as a substitute for Pausanias. The Athenians retorted by telling the Lacedaemonians to drive out what the god himself had pronounced to be a curse, to return to the Medism of Pausanias. Matter was found in the course of the inquiry to implicate Themistocles, and the Lacedaemonians accordingly sent envoys to the Athenians and required them to punish him as they had punished Pausanias. The Athenians consented to do so, but he had, as it happened, been ostracized, and, with a residence at Argos, was in the habit of visiting other parts of Peloponnese. So they sent with the Lacedaemonians, who were ready to join in the pursuit, persons with instructions to take him wherever they found him. But Themistocles got scent of their intentions and fled from Peloponnese to Corcyra, which was under obligations towards him. But the Corcyrians alleged that they could not venture to shelter him at the cost of offending Athens and Lacedaemon, and they conveyed him over to the continent opposite. Pursued by the officers who hung on the report of his movements, at a loss where to turn, he was compelled to stop at the house of Admetus, the Molossian king, though they were not on friendly terms. Admetus happened not to be indoors, but his wife, to whom he had made himself a suppliant, instructed him to take their child in his arms and sit down by the hearth. Soon afterwards Admetus came in, and Themistocles told him who he was, and begged him not to revenge on Themistocles in exile any opposition which his request might have experienced from Themistocles at Athens. Indeed, he was now far too low for his revenge. Retaliation was only honorable between equals. Besides, his opposition to the king had only affected the success of a request, not the safety of his person. If the king were to give him up to the pursuers that he mentioned, and the fate which they intended for him, he would just be consigning him to certain death. The king listened to him, and raised him up with his son, as he was sitting with him in his arms, after the most effectual method of supplication, and on the arrival of the Lacedaemonians not long afterwards, refused to give him up for anything they could say, but sent him off by land to the other sea, to Pydna, in Alexander's domains, as he wished to go to the Persian king. There he met with a merchantman on the point of starting for Ionia. Going on board, he was carried by a storm to the Athenian squadron which was blockading Naxos. In his alarm, he was luckily unknown to the people in the vessel. He told the master who he was and what he was flying for, and said that if he refused to save him, he would declare that he was taking him for a bribe. Meanwhile, their safety consisted in letting no one leave the ship until a favorable time for sailing should arise. If he complied with his wishes, he promised him a proper recompense. The master acted as he desired, and after lying to for a day and a night out of reach of the squadron, at length arrived at Ephesus. After having rewarded him with a present of money, as soon as he received some from his friends at Athens and from his secret hoards at Argos, Themistocles started inland with one of the coast Persians, and sent a letter to King Artaxerxes, Xerxes' son, who had just come to the throne. Its contents were as follows: I, Themistocles, am come to you, who did your house more harm than any of the Hellenes, when I was compelled to defend myself against your father's invasion. Harm, however, far surpassed by the good that I did him during his retreat, which brought no danger from me but much for him. For the past, you are a good turn in my debt. Here he mentioned the warning sent to Xerxes from Salamis to retreat, as well as his finding the bridges unbroken, which, as he falsely pretended, was due to him. For the present, able to do you great service, I am here, pursued by the Hellenes for my friendship for you. However, I desire a year's grace, when I shall be able to declare in person the objects of my coming." It is said that the king approved his intention, and told him to do as he said. He employed the interval in making what progress he could in the study of the Persian tongue, and of the customs of the country. Arrived at court at the end of the year, he attained to very high consideration there, such as no Hellene has ever possessed before or since. Partly from his splendid antecedents, partly from the hopes which he held out of effecting for him the subjugation of Hellas, but principally by the proof which experience daily gave of his capacity. For Themistocles was a man who exhibited the most indubitable signs of genius. Indeed, in this particular he has a claim on our admiration quite extraordinary and unparalleled. By his own native capacity, alike unformed and unsupplemented by study, he was at once the best judge in those sudden crises which admit of little or no deliberation, and the best prophet of the future, even to its most distant possibilities. An able theoretical expositor of all that came within the sphere of his practice, he was not without the power of passing an adequate judgment in matters in which he had no experience. He could also excellently divine the good and evil which lay hid in the unseen future. In fine, whether we consider the extent of his natural powers or the slightness of his application, this extraordinary man must be allowed to have surpassed all others in the faculty of intuitively meeting an emergency. Disease was the real cause of his death, though there is a story of his having ended his life by poison, on finding himself unable to fulfill his promises to the king. However this may be, there is a monument to him in the marketplace of Asiatic Magnesia. He was governor of the district, the king having given him Magnesia, which brought in 50 talents a year, for bread, Lampsacus, which was considered to be the richest wine country, for wine, and Myos for other provisions. His bones, it is said, were conveyed home by his relatives in accordance with his wishes, and interred in Attic ground. This was done without the knowledge of the Athenians, as it is against the law to bury in Attica an outlaw for treason. So ends the history of Pausanias and Themistocles, the Lacedaemonian and the Athenian, the most famous men of their time in Hellas. To return to the Lacedaemonians, the history of their first embassy, the injunctions which it conveyed, and the rejoinder which it provoked, concerning the expulsion of the accursed persons, have been relayed already. It was followed by a second, which ordered Athens to raise the siege of Potidaea and to respect the independence of Aegina. Above all, it gave her most distinctly to understand that war might be prevented by the revocation of the Megara decree, excluding the Megarians from the use of Athenian harbors and of the market of Athens. But Athens was not inclined either to revoke the decree or to entertain their other proposals. She accused the Megarians of pushing their cultivation into the consecrated ground and the unenclosed land on the border, and of harboring her runaway slaves. At last an embassy arrived with the Lacedaemonian ultimatum. The ambassadors were Ramphias, Melesippus, and Agesander. Not a word was said on any of the old subjects. There was simply this: "Lacedaemon wishes the peace to continue, and there is no reason why it should not, if you would leave the Hellenes independent." Upon this the Athenians held an assembly, and laid the matter before their consideration. It was resolved to deliberate once and for all on all their demands, and to give them an answer. There were many speakers who came forward and gave their support to one side or the other, urging the necessity of war, or the revocation of the decree and the following of allowing it to stand in the way of peace. Among them came Pericles, son of Xanthippus, the first man of his time at Athens, ablest alike in counsel and in action, and gave the following advice: "There is one principle, Athenians, which I hold to through everything, and that is the principle of no concession to the Peloponnesians. I know that the spirit which inspires men while they are being persuaded to make war is not always retained in action, that as circumstances change, resolutions change. Yet I see that now, as before, the same, almost literally the same, counsel is demanded of me, and I put it to those of you who are allowing yourselves to be persuaded to support the national resolves even in the case of reverses, or to forfeit all credit for their wisdom in the event of success. For sometimes the course of things is as arbitrary as the plans of man. Indeed, This is why we usually blame chance for whatever does not happen as we expected. Now it was clear before that Lacedaemon entertained designs against us. It is still more clear now. The treaty provides that we shall mutually submit our differences to legal settlement, and that we shall meanwhile each keep what we have. Yet the Lacedaemonians never yet made us any such offer, never yet would accept from us any such offer. On the contrary, they wish complaints to be settled by war instead of by negotiation. And in the end, we find them here dropping the tone of expostulation and adopting that of command. They order us to raise the siege of Potidaea, to let Aegina to be independent, to revoke the Megara decree, and they conclude with an ultimatum warning us to leave the Hellenes independent. I hope that you will none of you think that we shall be going to war for a trifle if we refuse to revoke the Megara decree, which appears in front of their complaints, and the revocation of which is to save us from war, or let any feeling of self-reproach linger in your minds, as if you went to war for slight cause. Why, this trifle contains the whole seal and trial of your resolution. If you give way, you will instantly have to meet some greater demand, as having been frightened into obedience in the first instance, while a firm refusal will make them clearly understand that they must treat you more as equals. Make your decision, therefore, at once, either to submit before you are harmed, or if we are to go to war, as I for one think we ought, to do so without caring whether the ostensible cause be great or small, resolved against making concessions or consenting to a precarious tenure of our possessions. For all claims from an equal, urged upon a neighbor as commands before any attempt at legal settlement, be they great or be they small, have only one meaning, and that is slavery. As to the war and the resources of either party, a detailed comparison will not show you the inferiority of Athens. Personally engaged in the cultivation of their land, without funds either private or public, the Peloponnesians are also without experience in long wars across sea, from the strict limit which poverty imposes on their attacks upon each other. Powers of this description are quite incapable of either manning a fleet or sending out an army. They cannot afford the absence from their homes, the expenditure from their own funds, and besides, they have not command of the sea. Capital, it must be remembered, maintains a war more than forced contributions. Farmers are a class of men that are always more ready to serve in person than in purse. Confident that the former will survive the dangers, they are by no means so sure that the latter will not be prematurely exhausted, especially if the war lasts longer than they expect, which it very likely will. In a single battle, the Peloponnesians and their allies may be able to defy all Hellas, but they are incapacitated from carrying on a war against a power different in character from their own by the want of the single council chamber requisite to prompt and vigorous action, and the substitution of a diet composed of various races, in which every state possesses an equal vote, and each presses its own ends, a condition of things which generally results in no action at all. The great wish of some is to avenge themselves on some particular enemy, the great wish of others to save their own pocket. Slow in assembling, they devote a very small fraction of the time to the considerations of any public object, most of it to the prosecution of their own objects. Meanwhile, each fancies that no harm will come of his neglect, that it is the business of somebody else to look after this matter or that. And so, by the same notion being entertained by all separately, the common cause imperceptibly decays. But the principal point is the hindrance that they will experience from the want of money. The slowness with which it comes in will cause delay, but the opportunities of war wait for no man. Again, we need not be alarmed either at the possibility of their raising fortifications in Attica or at their navy. It would be difficult for any system of fortifications to establish a rival city, even in time of peace, much more surely in an enemy's country, with Athens just as much fortified against it as it against Athens. While a mere post might be able to do some harm to the country by incursions and by the facilities which it would afford for desertion, but can never prevent our sailing into their country and raising fortifications there and making reprisals with our powerful fleet. For our naval skill is of more use to us for service on land than their military skill for service at sea. Familiarity with the sea they will not find an easy acquisition. If you who have been practicing at it ever since the Median invasion have not yet brought it to perfection, is there any chance of anything considerable being effected by an agricultural, unseafaring population, who will besides be prevented from practicing by the constant presence of strong squadrons of observation from Athens? With a small squadron, they might hazard an engagement, encouraging their ignorance by numbers. But the restraint of a strong force will prevent their moving, and through want of practice they will grow more clumsy, and consequently more timid. It must be kept in mind that seamanship, just like anything else, is a matter of art, and will not admit of being taken up occasionally as an occupation for times of leisure. On the contrary, it is so exacting as to leave leisure for nothing else. Even if they were to touch the monies at Olympia or Delphi, and try to seduce our foreign sailors by the temptation of higher pay, that would only be a serious danger if we could not still be a match for them by embarking our own citizens and the aliens resident among us. But in fact, by this means, we are always a match for them, and best of all, we have a larger and higher class of native coxswains and sailors among our own citizens than all the rest of Hellas. And to say nothing of the danger of such a step, none of our foreign sailors would consent to become an outlaw from this country, and to take service with them and their hosts, for the sake of a few days' high pay. This, I think, is a tolerably fair account of the position of the Peloponnesians. That of Athens is free from the defects that I have criticized in them, and has other advantages of its own, which they can show nothing to equal. If they march against our country, we will sail against theirs, and it will be then found that the desolation of the whole of Attica is not the same as that of even a fraction of Peloponnese, for they will not be able to supply the deficiency except by a battle. While we have plenty of land, both on the islands and the continent, the rule of the sea is indeed a great matter. Consider for a moment. Suppose that we were islanders. Can you conceive a more impregnable position? Well, this in future should, as far as possible, be our conception of our position. Dismissing all thoughts of our land and houses, we must vigilantly guard the sea and the city. No irritation that we may feel for the former must provoke us to a battle with the numerical superiority of the Peloponnesians. A victory would only be succeeded by another battle against the same superiority. A reverse involves the loss of our allies, the source of our strength, who will not remain quiet a day after we become unable to march against them. We must cry not over the loss of houses and land, but of men's lives, since houses and land do not gain men, but men them. And if I had thought that I could persuade you, I would have bid you go out and lay them waste with your own hands, and show the Peloponnesians that this at any rate will not make you submit. I have many other reasons to hope for a favorable issue, if you can consent not to combine schemes of fresh conquest with the conduct of the war, and will abstain from willfully involving yourselves in other dangers. Indeed, I am more afraid of our own blunders than of the enemy's devices. But these matters shall be explained in another speech, as events require. For the present, dismiss these men with the answer that we will allow Megara the use of our market and harbors, when the Lacedaemonians suspend their alien acts in favor of us and our allies, there being nothing in the treaty to prevent either one or the other, that we will leave the cities independent, if independent we found them when we made the treaty. And when the Lacedaemonians grant to their cities an independence not involving subservience to Lacedaemonian interests, but such as each severally may desire, that we are willing to give the legal satisfaction which our agreements specify, and that we shall not commence hostilities, but shall resist those who do commence them. This is an answer agreeable at once to the rights and the dignity of Athens. It must be thoroughly understood that war is a necessity, but that the more readily we accept it, the less will be the ardor of our opponents, and that out of the greatest dangers, communities and individuals acquire the greatest glory. Did not our fathers resist the Medes, not only with resources far different from ours, but even when those resources had been abandoned? And more by wisdom than by fortune, more by daring than by strength, did not they beat off the barbarian and advance their affairs to their present height? We must not fall behind them, but must resist our enemies in any way and every way, and attempt to hand down our power to our posterity unimpaired. Such were the words of Pericles. The Athenians, persuaded of the wisdom of his advice, voted as he desired, and answered the Lacedaemonians as he recommended, both on the separate points and in the general. They would do nothing on dictation, but were ready to have the complaint settled in a fair and impartial manner by the legal method, by which the terms of the truce prescribed. So the envoys departed home and did not return again. These were the charges and differences existing between the rival powers before the war, arising immediately from the affair at Epidamnus and Corcyra. Still intercourse continued in spite of them, and mutual communication. It was carried on without heralds, but not without suspicion, as events were occurring which were equivalent to a breach of the treaty and matter for war. This is the end of Book 1.